I will freely admit this now, and it's not done without any sense of guilt, but I must freely admit at the outset of this conversation on pop culture that I am a consumer. I am a consumer of this stuff. Not all of it. I don't consume as much television as I used to, but that has nothing to do with my tastes and has nothing to do with my proclivities. It has everything to do with the fact that I've got kids who have tons of homework, so we just don't have time for television. Movies, yes. Anyone who listens to this program on a regular basis, I like watching the movies. Music, not so much. Maybe more, a little more talk radio. I have to admit that I am a consumer of pop culture. But what does that mean? If I'm unaware and if I am simply taking in what I receive, what spiritual insights, what kind of catechesis does the pop culture do for the average American like me? If you're unaware, if you have nothing with which to compare it. You know, Christians are worried that religion is being pushed out of the public square. I think the danger is, in fact, the opposite. Religion is everywhere in pop culture. But to what end? We're going to answer that question here with Terry Mattingly during this hour of Issues, Etc. Feel free to join us. Our toll-free number, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727. We also have an in-studio email address. You can write us an email right now, and we'll get it right now, and we'll ask and answer your question or address your comment, issuesetc@kfuo.org. issuesetc@kfuo.org. Terry Mattingly is a regular guest on the program. He's director of the Washington Journalism Center at the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities. He writes the On Religion column for the Scripps Howard News Service, and he's author of a new book, Pop Goes Religion, Faith in Popular Culture. Terry, welcome back.
Good to talk to you again.
How typical am I as a consumer of pop culture, and where is the typical American like me getting his religious insights?
Well, typical American like you is the first question we need to ask about there, because probably with your news consumption and a lot of other things, you're probably not all that typical. And you said in your intro that your own use of television has probably declined quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
So let's go ahead and say that you're not typical. But there's two different groups of people I want to talk about in terms of popular culture and religion, and they're two distinct groups of people. If you use George Barna's categories, I assume a lot of your listeners are familiar with the evangelical pollster George Barna.
Yeah.
But Barna has about 8-9% of the American population is what he would call consistent Bible believers, and then he has about another 38-40% who consider themselves born again in some sense. They've had some sort of spiritual experience with Christ that is important to their lives. So let's just say 40%, okay? So if you've got 40% of the population that we're going to call basically Christian in some meaningful sense of the word, and then we have, like, say, 10% hard secularist or 20%, you've got another 40. So I'm interested in two groups of people. I'm interested in knowing how people who take Christian faith somehow seriously, what are they doing with pop culture? And the other is this kind of the great middle ground, the ground that I call Oprah America. How is that center of the spectrum between the very religious and the very non-religious? How is that group relating to issues of marriage, meaning, life, death, failure, hope, you know, all of those big button subjects that are a part of human life? And I start off with the presupposition that a lot of that people are getting at the mall. That instead of going to church, to some degree they go to the mall, either in the way of shopping, even in the way of popular books, popular culture, or the multiplex that's at the mall, which is where they have film, which is where they get heroes, which is where they get stories that tell them what is good and what is bad, what is beautiful and what is ugly, what is smart and what is dumb. All of these are things that our pop culture does for us very well. To me, the really huge question, and for more than a decade, ever since I was teaching at Denver Seminary, I've been lobbying for someone to take this seriously. Somebody needs to actually do some kind of study on the role that mass media and popular culture play in the lives of people who think of themselves as conservative Christians. Because the only time anybody's ever even asked a question about it, they found out that the media habits of people who call themselves conservative Christians are almost identical to the secular public. And if that's the case, I would argue, to put it bluntly, that there are far more young Christians in America being influenced by Will and Grace than there are young gay activists being influenced by Left Behind novels.
Josh McDowell has just written a book, co-authored a book. It landed on my desk a couple days ago. I think it's called something like The Last Christian Generation. And I didn't have time to look through it, but I was looking at the dust jacket and it said, you know, we've got young people who don't believe what Christians have typically believed. Their belief system has varied greatly from anything resembling a scriptural kind of Christian faith or a creedal kind of faith. And he blames the culture. But I'm looking at this dust jacket, Terry, and I'm thinking to myself, before you blame the culture, Josh, you might want to look at how the culture is infiltrated and sometimes been welcomed into the Christian church. You write about that blurring between religious culture and pop culture. Talk about that.
Well, I mean, two ways. One is that a lot of American religion, church has become largely an entertainment event, or at least an event in which entertainment values are very, very important. Last year, the New York Times did a huge cover story about a megachurch in the outskirts of the Phoenix area. And just for one example, I was struck by the detail that this particular church, when new boys join their Sunday school, they give them like Game Boys as a gift. And that scares the living daylights out of me, and I almost don't care what's on the Game Boy. I mean, in terms of they could be doing, you know, David versus Goliath first-person sword battles for all, you know, on there for all I care. I'm talking about the role that video game system then plays in that boy's life. And what you're saying about the church in that sense. The other thing is, if you go to church for somewhere between 1 and 3 hours a week and you consume television, video, or video games for 60 hours a week, is that a fair fight?
Has the, let's talk about, if we can generalize, has mainstream American Christianity, I often call it pop Christianity for short, has it ceased to be, in any real sense, except in its claims, which are, in my opinion, hollow, countercultural?
Well, one of the things about, and I don't want to turn this into an episode of bashing on evangelicals, but one of the things about evangelicalism is it has always done what it needed to do to appeal to a large number of folks. I grew up Southern Baptist, and in most arguments involving Southern Baptist clergy, the man with the larger church wins. So if you're in a culture that is dominated by the consumption of entertainment products, we should not be surprised that most megachurch pastors are highly attractive, youngish men who could communicate, you know, that could sell sand to the Arabs, as a lot of folks would say, and a very high percentage of them are funny. Should we be surprised by that?
I'm trying to get to kind of fundamental principles here before we get into some of these regions of pop culture and talk about the particulars. But has a significant line been crossed in that Christians now think of themselves not only in their everyday workaday world as consumers, but on Sunday morning as consumers?
Well, yeah, and they go and they kind of go to churches that compete for their attention in terms of quality of music, quality of preaching, quality of lights, quality of sound, quality of plasma screens. I've seen statistics that 75% to 80% of the churches in America that are growing have added massive video technology to the front of their sanctuaries. To what degree are they competing for eyes, ears, and attention span? Jeff, I think you and I have talked about, hold it, Jeff Swartz is your producer.
Yeah,
I got the wrong name.
That's all right.
I apologize.
That's all right.
The we've talked in the past about three questions that I use a lot, and they're mentioned in my book as well. When I was teaching in seminary, and I used to talk to future pastors about this, I tried to break it down into very simple questions that they could talk about with their congregation. And those three questions are, how do you spend your time? How do you spend your money? And how do you make your decisions? And those are just building block questions of life. Yet I think for most Americans, that if they asked those three questions and were very candid with themselves, they would conclude that entertainment media is one of the dominant forces in their life, if not the biggest source of humor, stories, visual impressions of other people, you know, et cetera.
Let's talk.
And that's kind of scary.
We're talking with Terry Mattingly about religion and pop culture. He's director of the Washington Journalism Center at the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities. He writes the On Religion column for the Scripps Howard News Service and has authored the new book, Pop Goes Religion, Faith in Popular Culture. Our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727, and our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Terry, let's turn our attention to popular music and the... You write early about the phenomenon of U2, the pop group U2,
right.
And the way that what was maybe 15, 20 years ago in their career, everything very controversial, now they're kind of considered shining examples, representatives of Christians out there in the world making their artistic mark. Talk about this.
Well, two things. One, in the book, it's crucial to understand that U2 is a group that may have had some influence on music in Christian context, but the band is not concerned about that at all. You know, if you walk into a church and the musicians sound like U2, that is something that would U2 would be appalled at, okay? But the other point is that U2 is a group, and you don't have to agree with their politics, and you don't even have to agree with their theology. U2 is an example of a band that instead of turning Sunday morning into a nightclub, you know, where church begins to sound more like entertainment, U2 is a group that has found a way to express Christian faith in some pretty blunt ways in the middle of the marketplace of American entertainment. And frankly, I would prefer to have more super talented young Christians performing music with faith content that is heard by the whole world rather than having them try to take their rock and roll style and content and convert Sunday morning music into that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. What does it tell you then that I'm looking back no more than a year, I think, to the cover of several weekly magazines here in the U.S. that were talking about the unbelievable commercial success that is this new sector of pop music, contemporary Christian music. It people are buying this stuff.
Well, okay, we got a problem here. All of those stories were written, or almost all of those stories were written, during a year that followed a very interesting anomaly. Most of the statistics that you saw 2 years ago when they talked about the phenomenal rise of Christian music, that was being fueled by several things. It was being fueled by POD, which is not a band on a Christian label, Creed, not a band on a Christian label, and Christian record sellers counted the soundtrack to the movie Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Really?
As Christian sales. So if you actually looked, and I could point your listeners toward a website where a friend of mine has done a lot of writing about this. It's really the reason, you know, it's what he lives for. you could make a case that sales of overtly Christian label music have actually declined. Whereas, meanwhile, we've had a series of very successful bands that are secular bands that contain Christians and their faith content is a part of what they do, like Switchfoot.
Okay, so really...
The thing with Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, though, is huge. Because that was what? How many platinums was that record? Five?
Well, yeah.
Yeah. It was a gigantic record. And it also was very overtly religious. It was produced by a man named T-Bone Burnett, who's a controversial guy in his own right, but is someone who is an outspoken Christian and good buddy of U2, by the way.
Okay. I don't want to get too far from that because I kind of want to come back around to how the headline in those weeklies made it sound as though kind of the CCM industry was somehow breaking into pop culture and people were saying, wow, we really do like listening to these CCM groups, when in fact, as you point out, it was not that. But since we're on Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, you in one of the chapters here on pop music, you quote a regular guest here on our program, Dr. Gene Edward Veith, who had written this book some time back. We talked to him about it as well, Honky Tonk Gospel.
Right.
I happen to be a country music fan, and one of the reasons I like it is because that music is talking about me. And it's also talking about it in the categories as a Christian that I think are real categories,
yeah.
Sin and salvation.
Yeah. Yeah. It's sin is something that you can talk about in country music. Sin is not something that comes up a lot on MTV. A lot of country mythology is based on this. I mean, the way I put it in the book, Elvis Presley is not the first country Baptist to go to town and get corrupted and fall. That is a part of a lot of scenarios related to country music. I like how Naomi Judd once put it in an interview that I did with her. Naomi said that a lot of country songs are about cheating. And she said, but even the concept of cheating implies that there's something to cheat against. You don't hear a lot of cheating songs on MTV. Because there is no institution, there is no wedding band on the finger of most of the singers, right? Even when country music is singing about Saturday night, a part of the worldview of its industry is that Sunday morning still exists.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's significant. And I think the growing numbers for country music in mainstream American musical taste is more, there's more to that than the fact that that baby boomers like to hear acoustic guitars, you know, in the post-Crosby, Stills, Nash age or something like that.
One of the things that strikes me at country music as well, and I think about the songs that have appealed to me, not only the reality of sin in the life that's portrayed there, but also, I am very hesitant to use the term family values, but oftentimes in country music, in particular, music performed by male country music artists, they talk about their wife and they talk about their kids and they talk about them not as my mama's baby or whatever. These are my kids and this is my life and this is my home and this is what they love.
Yeah, and lots of different artists will perform songs of that kind. But here's the big thing. You and I can talk about the positive, I mean, the fact that they do this. The other side is that they're not punished if they do it. It isn't considered a risky career move to get up on a stage in country music and sing a song about your wife. Isn't that interesting?
Before we go to this break, let's talk a little bit about movies. If you had to put your finger on one movie that has been a box office success in the last decade, that is perhaps maybe the silver screen catechism for the average American, what would it be?
Star Wars. I think if you were looking at the classic American story, global story, that took some sort of vague spirituality and made people walk around feeling it, you would have to conclude that Star Wars is the dominant franchise.
What is that spirituality that's taught there, that's being portrayed there?
There's good and there's evil, but none of it's very specific. Emotions are what you trust, not your head. And gosh, it's great if things are exciting.
So a little action. Trust your feelings, Luke.
Trust your feelings, Luke.
And know who the bad guy is, although you might, if you trust the wrong feelings, become the bad guy.
Yeah, although you're supposed to trust your feelings to become the good guy. Yeah, I mean, poor Anakin is nothing but a cauldron of feelings. And everybody's telling him to trust his feelings. The bad guys and the good guys.
Terry, I watched the last installment of Star Wars, and I watched it just rung in my head, trust your feelings, at that point in the movie that you're talking about. And I thought to myself, you know, George Lucas is not the greatest writer in the world. But people believe it, don't they?
That's the dominant message in all of American pop culture, is that feelings and emotions are the driving force of life. That, and you could make the case that, you know, feelings and physical appearances are what life is all about.
Terry Mattingly is our guest. We're talking about religion and pop culture. Feel free to join us. This break is a great time to call 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727, or to email us right here in the studio, issuesetc@kfuo.org, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Terry Mattingly is author of the On Religion column for the Scripps Hours Nude Service, and you can read it on the web at tmatt.net. It's tmatt.net, tmatt.net. Look for the On Religion column by Terry Mattingly, our guest. He's authored the book Pop Goes Religion, Faith and Popular Culture. When we come back from this break, we'll continue our conversation with him on this subject, turning not just to the big screen, and you'll find it at the Cineplex, but when the Cineplex moves into Sunday morning. It's one of those kind of things, if you're trying to parody it, you couldn't do it anymore. The pastor who decides, after he's seen a movie Saturday night, that it would make a great sermon on Sunday morning. So when it comes out on DVD, he goes out and he rents it and he brings it in and he puts it up on the big screen on Sunday morning. And instead of his sermon, and it happens, folks, instead of his sermon, let's watch 20 minutes of this movie that just really touched me. And I think there's something we can learn from this. So what are the lessons being taught in pulpits when the silver screen visits on Sunday morning? We'll also talk about the other aspects of pop culture. Television, of course, is one, and we cannot leave our conversation behind with Terry Mattingly without discussing the new opening venue of pop culture, and who knows where it will lead, the Internet. 1-800-730-2727 is our call-in number and our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Stay tuned.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc. Do you find it to be a struggle when you read the Old Testament? Lots of judgment, wrath, and punishment, and what seems to be very little grace, mercy, and peace. Well, you'll find our Issues, Etc. book of the month for February a helpful resource. It's the Concordia Commentary on Ezekiel. For more information, you can call Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number is 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Or you can find out more on our website, issuesetc.org. This new Bible commentary costs $42.99 plus shipping and handling. The Concordia Commentary on Ezekiel is written by Dr. Horace Hummel, 1-800-325-3040, or issuesetc.org. How are the visions and oracles in Ezekiel relevant to God's people today? And where do we find Jesus in this Old Testament book? Find out with a Concordia Commentary on Ezekiel, our Issues, Etc. book of the month for February.
6 literal days. Why did God take so long?
Answers with Ken Ham, president of the Bible Proclaiming Ministry of Answers in Genesis. Well, Ken, that was a rather interesting way of putting it. A period of 6 days is really only a short time?
Well, at many of the meetings I speak at, I often ask people the following questions. Could the infinite creator God have created everything in just 6 minutes? People, of course, acknowledge God could do that. Well, how about 6 seconds? Well, God could certainly do that. I then ask, could he have created in no time at all? Well, again, people answer, the infinite creator could certainly do this. Then I like to ask this question, could God have created everything in 6 days? Of course, I have to acknowledge that this could be so. I then explain to the people that it's not a matter of what God could have done, but what he said he did. When you take Genesis chapter 1 as written, the word day in context means an ordinary day. This fits with what God told Moses in Exodus chapter 20 as to why he took 6 days. This was to be the basis of the 7-day week, 6 days of work followed by 1 day of rest. That's why God took so long, 6 days, to create the universe.
Ken Ham is a faith-building booklet that shows how believing in long ages for the earth actually undermines the gospel message. For that surprising connection, read his booklet on your computer screen after you go to AnswersRadio.com. The booklet's free at AnswersRadio.com.
Issues, etc. is underwritten in part by St. Paul's Lutheran Church in Wildwood. St. Paul's Lutheran is located at 955 Highway 109 in Wildwood. The Reverend Doug Balzer is the pastor. Their phone number, area code 636-273-6239, 273-6239. St. Paul's Lutheran Church in Wildwood, www.stpaullutheranwildwood.org.
You're invited to spend part of your Sunday mornings with us here at AM 850 KFUO. Every Sunday morning, we bring you 2 worship broadcasts. Our early church service comes from Peace Lutheran Church in St. Louis at 8 a.m. The pastor at Peace is the Reverend Dennis Castens. Our second service comes from Village Lutheran Church in Ladue and begins at 10:45. The Reverend John Temple is the pastor. We're pleased to bring you these 2 worship broadcasts every Sunday on AM 850 KFUO. Inspirational Christian radio for the world.
Quick look at AM 850 KFUO weather. Cloudy skies tonight, partly cloudy late with a low of 21. Increasing clouds tomorrow and a high of only 29. It's 41 now at AM 850 KFUO.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're talking with Terry Mattingly about religion and pop culture. Terry is author of the new book called Pop Goes Religion, Faith in Popular Culture. While we're on the subject of books, before we go on with our conversation, our Issues Etc. book of the month is another great book. It is an in-depth commentary on the book of Ezekiel. Many Christians find it very difficult to understand. This book will help. It's written by noted Old Testament scholar Dr. Horace Hummel. It's the Concordia Commentary on the book of Ezekiel, the first 20 chapters. And it's $42.99 plus shipping and handling. Go to our website to find out more about the book, issuesetc.org, or order by calling Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours. Their toll-free number, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Ask for the Issues Etc. Book of the Month. It's the Concordia Commentary on Ezekiel. Terry, the big screen, I'm a movie buff. I love the whole movie experience. And a couple of years ago, I remember someone joking to me that, a pastor might decide someday that he really liked a movie on Saturday night and use it as a sermon on Sunday morning, not just as an illustration, but actually get a clip in there. That's happening now. What's going on?
Well, first of all, in most Protestant settings, what goes on Sunday morning is something that's totally in the hands of just a few people. I've argued, and back when I was at Denver Seminary, that it's perfectly acceptable for ministers to debate their culture, you know, from the pulpit, and that being able to dissect a film and find out what it's actually saying and somehow respond to it is the sort of thing that missionaries do when they go to other cultures. They do the same things with the humor and the stories and the images of that culture. Now, to me, the more interesting question you're raising, one that's settled for me because of my own church affiliation, is the issue of whether you actually bring the mass media into the worship service itself. And I really do not believe you should, because I think all you're doing is teaching your reinforcing that media usage in your congregation and saying that entertainment is what we're here for. The whole idea that, you know, someone's going to be walking forward to receive communion while you're showing clips from The Sopranos, you know, that were used earlier to set the mood during the sermon, I'm just not sure that that's what communion is all about. Now, I'm from a worship tradition where use of such media would be absolutely anathema. I'm from a church, I'm a convert to Eastern Orthodoxy. We don't even need electricity. You know, we're multimedia in a host of different ways with all kinds of smells, bells, pageantry, and whatever. But if the power goes out, you just light more candles.
I got to ask then, you know, if it's a typical Orthodox church, you got the iconostasis there at the front.
Of course.
And someone is going to say, now, Terry, come on, you guys just, your pictures just don't move. Ours do, and all we're doing is the same thing you guys are doing. We just have the plasma screen.
Well, that's a very valid thing, except that most people do not consider prayers at an iconostasis to be the same thing as watching clips from a Pixar movie in terms of entertainment value.
Give it time. Give it time.
well, give it time for... Are you talking about
if you give it enough
Pixar
time,
clips and praying?
Yes, you...
I think that'll be a long wait.
All right. Okay, the small screen then. Television is, more than anything else, really the lubrication of American culture now.
I love Ken Myers in his classic book, All God's Children in Blue Suede Shoes. He just simply hauled off and said it. He said, simply stated, in television we live and move and have our being.
So what is religion on television?
Well, of course, you've got religious programs on TV, but basically religion on television is those same kinds of stories we were talking about in film, only developed out over a longer period of time. The other thing that happens in television is it becomes terribly important in a series who you like and who you don't like. You know, if you're going to spend like 5 years growing to admire a particular character, you're probably going to pick up some general ideas and impressions from that character over time. Newsweek, a couple of years ago, in a very controversial image, because of the social issue attached with it, they simply referred to this effect over time as the Will and Grace effect, because there was some research they were quoting that showed that the amount of time that people spent watching the Will and Grace sitcom began over time to affect their views on gay rights issues.
Has television come to represent, with a few exceptions, has it come to represent a Sunday-less week? I'm thinking about this. One of my favorite shows from the old days is the Andy Griffith Show. Can't get enough of the characters. They're just lovable people. Maybe it's just nostalgia. But they had Sunday morning in Mayberry.
Yeah.
That day of the week actually came around occasionally. With the exception of a couple TV programs I know of, there are no Sundays, except for sitting at home and eating bagels or something.
Yeah, and there's going to be Sunday is going to come back to some degree in some shows, in large part because of the influence of that noted missionary effort by the religious right called The Simpsons, which is perhaps the single most religious show in the history of American television, if you're actually looking at how often is religious content a part of the show.
Well, I've argued that it's the most accurate picture of American culture on television, and in particular, the most accurate picture of American religious culture on television. Do you agree?
I don't know what the word accurate means in a show that is attempting to mock everything. The other thing, there was a book, The Gospel According to the Simpsons, done just a couple of months ago by the religion writer, maybe a year or two ago, by the religion writer at the Orlando Sun Sentinel named Mark Pinsky. And Mark Pinsky is a liberal, self-identified liberal Jew. He is a practicing Jew, but he would consider himself a liberal, both politically and theologically. Yet I think Pinsky's point is interesting, that even when the evangelical is talking on The Simpsons, the theological point of view of the show is essentially Judaism. It's essentially Ten Commandments and a works theology. But that's still, you know, that's a lot better than Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
I've got to ask you, while we're on television, what you make of the extremely bright burning but short life of the Book of Daniel, that it was supposed to be kind of a dramedy for that was going to take the world by storm, and the television barely flickered before it was gone.
Yeah, what I wish they would do is put a DVD out of the pitch session when somebody pitched that series. You know, in the wake of all that we've learned about American demographics in the last 4 or 5 years, who was it that thought that show was going to be a crossover hit in red zip code America? And are they currently unemployed? I mean, that to me was one of the most hysterically funny. I mean, that show was too far out for Episcopalians.
What struck me about that was the Jesus of the Book of Daniel.
Right.
I think a lot of American Christians would have found him very familiar, kind of the therapist Jesus. Just shows up in the passenger seat occasionally to help you with your problems.
Makes a few suggestions and leaves.
Yeah, and absolutely. The one thing he does not possess is a crown of thorns or holes in his hands and feet.
Yeah, there isn't any cross there, is there? I mean, if that Jesus walked on at Oprah, he would be a massive hit. That's the Jesus is my buddy. Jesus is a very wise person who offers me nice suggestions. That is not the C.S. Lewis image that if Jesus is who he claims he is, he's either the Son of God or a poached egg.
You brought her up, Oprah, who until very recently had her own spirituality segment on
right.
her popular talk show. How influential has her show and this person, Oprah Winfrey, been in American spirituality?
I don't know how much you can say she's influenced the church. Although I have been, well, I'll tell one anecdote about that. When I was at Denver Seminary, I had my students read the very, very strongly pantheistic New Age book called Return to Love by a best-selling author named Mary Ann Williamson, who was for a while the spiritual advisor to ABC and was one of Oprah's inner circle. And I had my students read this book for reasons of apologetics. And one of my students, who was from a very conservative Baptist church there in the Colorado Front Range, got really mad at me for requiring him to read this book as a class assignment. Well, a couple of weeks after that assignment was over, I was sitting in my office, and I looked up, and he was standing in my doorway one day, and he said, "Can I come in and talk for a second?" And I said, "Sure, come on in." And he sat down, he said, "I wanted to come and apologize about something." And I said, "What?" He said, "I want to apologize for knocking you for having us read A Return to Love." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Because last week our pastor's wife recommended it as the book for the next women's book study."
Oh, man.
"Because she saw it on Oprah. And it was all about love and peace and knowing yourself and forgiveness and all this other stuff. But all of the Christian language in this book had all been radically redefined in New Age pantheistic terms. But the pastor's wife of this almost fundamentalist Baptist church couldn't see what the book was because Oprah's her buddy. And Oprah prays, and Oprah's a believer, and yeah, God, it'd be great if Oprah went ahead and married that guy she's been living with for a decade. But you know, we can't be judgmental.
Well, I guess that raises the issue of to what degree the consumption of pop culture, with all of its images, both religious, spiritual, and otherwise, has damaged Christians' ability to discern not only what truth is, but what truth is in line with the faith they profess.
Well, people look for coherence, and they try to make sense of the things that they value and have accepted into their lives. The negative side of that is we can just say all of us rationalize. We all do. To me, it's part of the essence of sin. When I talk about pop culture, I say I don't think popular culture is all bad. I mean, I wouldn't have been a mass media professor trying to talk to young Christians about going to work in the entertainment industry and the world of journalism if I thought that mass media was somehow some part of God's creation that was more fallen, you know, than other professions. I think there are probably just about as many people messed up by preaching as by MTV. It's the issue to me is who gets to tell us stories that we use to make sense of our lives? Who tells us our parables and then interprets them for us? And I do not think you can ask that question without concluding that the dominant teller of parables in the lives of modern Americans, even the lives of our most conservative modern Americans, you would have to say that the dominant storyteller is the entertainment media.
Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727. And listeners with the best questions or comments, in the next 10 minutes with Terry Mattingly, we'll get his new book, Pop Goes Religion. Okay, Terry, then someone has listened so far in this conversation, and they say, I see what you're trying to say. You're trying to say, unplug the television, put it in the garage, maybe when we're retired, stop going to the movies and the mall, and withdraw from the pop culture,
no,
essentially.
No, I'm not saying that for several reasons. I just said I don't think entertainment media is more sinful and more fallen than other parts of God's creation. Second, that's not what missionaries do when they go to foreign cultures. Missionaries don't come into a culture and immediately stop paying attention to its humor, its music, its stories, its myths, and how people live their lives, right? That isn't how effective missionaries work. I'm asking that people do something even harder than lock it up in the closet in some sort of fake separatism. I'm suggesting they actually think. I'm also suggesting that they actually make decisions about what they will watch and what they won't watch, and that they actually establish limits. You know, when I was teaching at Denver Seminary, I used to do an exercise where I asked students to take one of several different options with their televisions. Option number one was turn it off completely for 2 weeks. Option number two is you could watch whatever you wanted to watch, but you had to rent it. Option number three was you could watch whatever you wanted to watch, but you had to tape it yourself on your own VCR. And option number four was you could watch whatever you wanted to watch, you just had to keep a chart of it, Nielsen style, in a notebook for discussion in class.
So what's the point of
the anecdote is that the students would plead with me. I would divide the class up into equal-sized units, and the students fought to see who got to be in the unit where they simply locked it away, because that required the least effort and the least thought. They would much rather ignore the TV for 2 weeks, perhaps catch up on their seminary homework, because they knew normal life would return, than be asked to actually make decisions about the content of that television. What we want is for this to all just be really easy and to make a large segment of our life go away. Or to quote Ken Myers, who dies when time is killed?
Let's not forget two other aspects of pop culture here before our conversation winds down, Terry. One being print and publishing, which I guess is going to, in many ways, include the Internet, which is just another form of disseminating print And at least
it's
that's
changing rapidly as more people go to faster forms than dial-up. We're beginning to watch the true emergence of digital media, but I'll accept your point that it's predominantly a print medium.
Okay, then let's talk about the two big books entirely in the realm of fantasy and how much difference you see between the two, if any. J.K. Rowling's very popular series of the Harry Potter novels that she's ready to finish within a year or two.
Right.
And then A Blast from the Past, C.S. Lewis's The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, also making it to the silver screen this year.
Right. Which is interesting because probably in the next day or two, I've been watching this carefully at boxofficemojo.com. It looks like Narnia will catch the latest Harry Potter movie probably this weekend at the box office, in American box office. Are you asking me to compare those two series?
No, I just want you to your general thoughts on both of them. I mean, Christians were wary of one and then not so wary of the other.
Yeah.
And Christians were concerned about witches in one and not concerned about witches in the other.
Yeah.
And they thought they were really doing a great job of exercising some careful discernment. What did you think?
Well, first of all, I've got several columns about Harry Potter that I've written in the past, and that a lot of that has ended up in the book. But I'm actually very, very pro-Harry Potter at this point. My own personal hunch is that J.K. Rowling is a left-of-center Christian, but she is very definitely a Christian, and she is using a tremendous amount of Christian symbolism in her books. And she has said repeatedly that her two favorite authors in the world and the two authors that have influenced her the most are C.S. Lewis and Jane Austen. So there's actually very much a connection between the seven books of the Chronicles of Narnia and the seven books of the Lord of the Rings and the seven books of Harry Potter. She's clearly tipping her hand as to who she's claiming as influences, isn't she?
And with regard to the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, did it surprise you at all that Lewis as an overt Christian lay theologian and tremendous author had a resurgence on the silver screen so elegantly?
Well, he's never gone away. The Chronicles of Narnia have continued to sell at like 1 million to 1.5 million a year ever since he wrote them. When I interviewed Douglas Gresham, C.S. Lewis's stepson, earlier this year, this was his big point. I mean, the question isn't why they made it into a movie. The question is, why hasn't the whole series been done a long time ago, other than the fact that the special effects were not available? But the Chronicles of Narnia is a publishing phenomena. I mean, come back in 50 years and let's see how Harry's selling, okay? If Harry Potter is selling 1 million a year 40 to 50 years from now, then we can talk about a phenomena.
Terry Mattingly is our guest. We're talking about religion and pop culture. Do you have any thoughts on the news? Because news has gone from being, at least in, I think, most people's minds, in the realm of here I am taking my medicine to squarely to entertainment.
That isn't my perception. My perception is the primary people who are continuing to consume news in its normal forms are thinking of it more and more as information other than perhaps television news. The other point I would make is that coming up under the age of 40 are a lot of people that make almost no distinction between entertainment and news at all. They think Comedy Central is a news channel. And they think Oprah is an investigative journalist or something. I don't know. So the line is blurring with the very young, but they're not consuming much. If you actually look at what news products are, you know, hanging in there, it tends to be with adults who are looking for information. And the Internet is very much that way. If you look at who uses the Internet, say, on election night, you're dealing with the most news-driven sector of the American population.
Then with only less than a minute here, Terry, really for me the key question, if we look out into the pop culture as both mirror and projector,
right.
Who is the Jesus of American pop culture?
The Jesus of American pop culture is a really nice guy who accepts you just the way they are. He's a good storyteller, and you're supposed to love him with your heart.
So we're right back to kind of the Star Wars thing. Is he also good looking? Good looking as Anakin Skywalker?
Well, that's the Jesus with muscles thing that's been popular ever since sports became one of the most popular forms of youth evangelism. I don't know much about how you even address a question like that seriously. I do know the key is that our media is driving us more and more into the world of feeling and emotion. And if the church goes there with the media, you should expect people's theology to evolve in the direction of feeling and emotion and doing what they want to do. And that, to me, is kind of scary.
Folks, here's our mailing address and our phone number to receive a complimentary copy of the next Issues Etc. journal or to help support Issues Etc. Talk Radio for the Thinking Christian. With a tax-deductible gift, our address, Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Our resource line number, 1-800-737-0172. The address again, Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117, or call our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. Terry Mattingly is a regular guest on the program. He's director of the Washington Journalism Center at the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities. He writes the On Religion column for the Scripps Howard News Service and author of the new book, Pop Goes Religion, Faith in Popular Culture. Be sure to check out Terry's website tonight, by the way. It's tmatt.net. TMATT.net. Terry, thanks for being our guest.
Thank you so much for having me back.
You know, the culture is what we make. When Christians get worried about the culture, the thing they usually worry about is its influence on their children or its influence or the lack of religion in the culture, that their viewpoint isn't represented. You know, maybe after this conversation, the greatest danger Christians ought to worry about, the thing that they ought to be most concerned about, is that their viewpoint is represented there. They just don't like what it is when the culture actually reflects what we believe and then it feeds it back to us again. What else can we expect the culture to do? That's what it does. Can't blame the culture for that. But what it reflects of us may call for a bit of repentance. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172. 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.